So we've got the passage of the narrow door, which Mark requested that we have a look at. And as a note, we'll be looking at some pieces of Luke through next year, and I'm very interested in which pieces of Luke you would like to hear about. So please come and tell me the bits you've always wanted to hear someone talk about, or I'm happy to take recommendations. In fact, I prefer it, because then I don't get to pick my favourite bits. But I'm going to start not talking about the passage specifically, but about how we read any passage. When I was reading commentaries to prepare for today, one of them, by Brendan Byrne, talked about his commentary as a reading of Luke. And he said, it's not the only reading, it's possibly not the most obvious reading, but it's a valid reading. And I found that a really helpful phrase to think about, what is a valid reading? And maybe there's more than one. So what makes a reading valid and how do we discern? Now, I could talk the whole session about that, but I'm just going to touch on it briefly and we might need to pick it up again some other time. So some of my suggestions about how to discern if it's a valid reading are to read the whole chapter, not just pick a verse out here and there. And even possibly to read the whole book, all of Luke, rather than just chapter 13. What's it saying overall? What's God like overall through this book? What is Jesus' message overall? And learn something about the book. They weren't written for us. They were written for someone else. Now, if we're going to eavesdrop on someone else's letters, we need to know who we're eavesdropping on. It would help. And we need to hold open that it might not say what it initially looks like saying. But then again, it might. That's some ideas about what it might mean in what's a valid reading of its original context, but there's the next layer of what's a valid reading of what it means for us now. And I would say, in discerning that, take the journey in company. Books, friends, your church, your family, but most of all, the company of the God who loves you. Read more of the book, not just Luke, but the other bits, the letters and the Hebrew experiences of God that come before these stories. Hold true to what you hold true. We all have a lens that we read with that is what we really, really believe about God or don't believe. Don't be ashamed of that. We all have one. The problem is only when we pretend we don't. How honestly we're willing to admit what our lens is. And if a passage seems to contradict your lens, run it backwards, turn it inside out. What do you have to do to that passage to make it work within what you hold true? If it's the only passage that doesn't fit with what you hold true, then hold it pretty lightly. But also be ready to have it challenged. Your lens could be smudged or cracked. You could be looking through the wrong end of the binoculars. We have someone at our house who does that quite a lot at the moment. Hold it and think, what do I have to do to this passage to make it fit? Am I really wringing the juice out of it so it fits what I want it to say? What might I be losing in that? What are the gifts of the other valid readings? And if you don't hold anything to be absolutely true, then walk very gently and don't let any one piece define your truth. Don't let the first convincing thing you come across shape what your truth is from there. Even if it's me, I can be very convincing. Be prayerfully open to surprises and move slowly to reach a conclusion. Let it rumble in your guts for a while and test it out before you let it settle. Check your reading with others that you trust. And invite God to guide you. Now, we're not very big on that here. Don't chuck out all the other processes, but be present to a living God who might have an opinion on the matter that you're working through. So with that to preface, let's have a look at the actual passage. And I'm going to give you what I think are four valid readings. Now, they layer over each other and you can have parts of each of them to some degree. Some of them start to be difficult to hold together. You don't have to agree with any of them, but hold that some of them may be valid and more than one of them may be valid. The majority reading of this text is that Jesus is issuing a loving but stern warning. You can't just waltz up into heaven and expect to get in. It's not going to be that easy. Some people are going to get turned away. And it's an image of a narrow gate in the defences of a city. There's the wide entrance gate, which is shut, and there's the narrow gate, which is guarded, and only one person can come through at a time. And if you don't have the right pass, you won't be permitted in. And if you come to try coming in on someone else's back, you won't fit. If you come as a team, you've got to still come through one at a time. So how do you get the right pass to enter the narrow door? And it says, strive, try very hard. Try to enter the narrow door. And this reading takes that as an interpretation that you have to work hard at getting the pass in. Live a good life and be faithful to God. At one end of the extreme of reading, there's a very difficult entrance exam, and you better study bloody hard to make sure you pass it. Now, within the same reading, some balk at the idea that you have to work hard to get into heaven and look at Jesus as the door. Being a Christian is the way into heaven. The tickets are free, you just have to make the effort to get one. Sometimes this is Jesus is the door of grace. If you accept Jesus as the one way, then you're admitted through the narrow door by grace alone. The striving is about paying attention, keeping your eyes on the goal. Not that you have to work hard, but you have to have a commitment to Jesus as the way, as the door. Another possibility is that Jesus is the firm judge at the door, sifting out those who did God's will from those who didn't. Bit of sheep and goats action. And possibly, the passage is also in Matthew. In Matthew, it's towards the end of the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus has laid out all sorts of teachings of the way of living, how to live this life he's talking about. And towards the end, he starts saying, don't just listen to what I'm saying, do something about it. And within that context, he also says, the path is narrow, leading to a narrow door. He's more interested in that context about the path. It's more of a road less travelled kind of an image. But it potentially has that overlay of, there's a judge at the end, did you choose the right path? The other part of this reading is that the door is narrow and it's shutting. I don't know if you heard that in what Heather read, that the master of the house is going to get up and shut the door, and you can knock all you like, but it's not going to get opened anymore. And within this reading, some really emphasise the weeping and gnashing of teeth and make this a real hellfire and damnation passage. Hurry up, quick, repent. Follow Jesus, get in that door, or he'll slam it in your face and you'll have missed out and be in hell forever. Don't get caught up in asking how many will be saved. Just make sure you're one of them. So this reading is a text then about the need to really follow Jesus, not just talk about being a Christian or talk about Jesus or tick Christian on the census form. This is a valid reading. It's not the one I favour, but I have to hold that it's a valid reading. The imagery doesn't sit well with me because my lens is that God is love and welcome. And I really struggle with the idea of the door slamming in your face. If this is the valid reading that you choose, most valid readings will have a part of it that rubs. And the piece you need to wrestle with is what you do with this image of the abundant feast. If the door is narrow and hard to get into and you have to work very hard, why are there thousands of people from all corners of the earth in there that they can see when they're outside gnashing their teeth? And the concluding piece about the last being first and the first being last, within this reading, it reads as if the first are going to be first. The ones who rush, hurry, push, struggle to get through that narrow door, get through. And the ones who maybe don't, well, then they get there and the door's shut. Now, that to me sounds like the last being pretty last. So the conclusion that the first will be last and the last will be first is the piece you'll need to wrestle with if this is the valid reading that you choose. It's probably not a big surprise to you that that's not the valid reading I choose. I've tried really hard to present it in a way that's not critical of it, and that's a struggle for me because it's easy to present it in a way that makes you all think, well, that can't be true. Brendan Byrne's commentary that I mentioned at the start is subtitled The Hospitality of God. He understands Luke as being about the hospitality of God. And I struggle to see this reading fitting within the idea of the hospitality of God. A second valid reading is to read this in light of a Jewish audience and Jewish concerns, that it's not about us, or by inference, it's about Christians with a sense of entitlement. So, Jesus is talking to a Jewish audience. Luke is written to a Gentile audience, but he's describing a situation of Jesus talking to a Jewish audience. He's their king, and he's amongst them, talking to them in the present for them. And on the whole, they won't accept that he's the king. And the window of opportunity is closing. He's on his way to Jerusalem. He's not with them much longer. Here he is among them, the door himself. And they are secure in their assumption that their Jewishness is the ticket. And they don't recognise that they're still outside the kingdom. Now, the person posing the question, how many will be saved, probably expected an answer of not very many, because it's a time of conflict between Jewish groups. When they're trying to determine which is the right Jewish group, this image of the messianic feast, the big banquet, it runs through Hebrew scriptures, and at the start, particularly in Isaiah, it's very broad. People are from all over. And then in, I think it's Enoch, it gets limited down to just the Jews at the feast. And then the Qumran community, which is present at the time of Jesus, it's only a select few Jews who are going to be there. So the question comes out of this context, well, how many will be saved? Is it this Isaiah feast, or is it the Qumran feast of just a few who've got it right? And Jesus says, yes, just a few of you, but actually quite a lot beyond your little clique. In fact, I'm getting up to close the door of Jewish entry altogether. But look, I'm here now, the one your parents and grandparents and ancestors have been hoping and longing for. I'm standing in your city square talking to you, and I want so very badly to bring you in with me. The time to repent is now. Don't delay. Get involved in the fulfillment of your ancestors' longings. Bring your Jewishness to the service of the servant king. So what does that say for us? And it is possible that this text is entirely to a past people. Although Luke is telling this story in his gospel to a Gentile audience, so for him, he's telling it, this story of Jesus interacting with the Jews, he thinks is relevant to a non-Jewish community. So it could be a warning to any religious group at any time that thinks they've got things all stitched up. A check on our sense of Christian entitlement. The word is strive. Strive for the narrative. Keep on checking back with the core teachings, with new developments, with the living presence of God. Be open to surprises and never assume that you're beyond the point of needing to seek God. That years ago you took a decision, joined some group, made an action, signed up for an institution, were born into a family, and that's your pass to God forever. Because they'll come from all over to that feast table, but it's not the exclusive party you're expecting. And I'm sure you've heard the joke about Peter showing new members around heaven, and there's the charismatics, oh, they're having a wonderful time, and there's the Catholics you can see with you, and it's always whichever group you're in, for me, there's the Lutherans. Why are they so miserable? Well, they thought they'd be the only ones here. So there's the weeping and the gnashing of teeth. It's something like, I want to be at God's party, but damn it, God's not throwing my sort of party. And I'm cross that God hasn't thrown the party I wanted, so I'm out here in the dark with no party at all. That's a second valid reading. A third reading is, I'm working with the work of Robert Farrar Capone, who's one of my very favourite theologians, and also I've put a couple of his books on the shelf over there if you want to have a flick through after and have a look. Both the previous two readings assume that the door is an image for Jesus, but Capone says the door is death. The door is death, while we're alive in a figurative sense, but eventually just deady dead dead. The passage begins with a reminder that they're on the road to Jerusalem. He went through all the cities and towns. Luke has this theme right through the central section, that he's on the road, he's on the road, he's heading for Jerusalem, and it begins this passage. And right after the bit we read, people come and warn him that Herod wants to kill him. And they say, don't go to Jerusalem, he's out to get you. And he says, no, I will go to Jerusalem, it's the right place for a prophet to die. So both ends of this passage are bookended with images about heading to Jerusalem and the death image. The door is narrow, not because it's hard to find and little, but because it's repulsive. Our ego wants to come in as honoured guests on the merits, but the narrow door is the beggar's door. Now, the thing I think is Capone's brilliance in this is he talks about this passage as about showing two doors, the narrow one and the shutting one, and that it's not the same door. The wide door, which is being closed, is the door of glory and achievement. And the narrow door, the only entry, is the low way of being, Capone uses the phrase over and over, the last, the least, the lost, the littlest, and the dead. This is where Jesus is. This is who Jesus is with. This is the only place where God can work with us. The last, the least, the lost, the littlest, and the dead. All the things that our culture and our ego desperately try to avoid being. So Capone calls this a parable of grace, because it's by God's supreme grace that we come close to God, not our achievements or even our excellent attitude. The door of death is also an image of Jesus as the door, but he's not the judge at the door. He's not even the hero at the door. He's not the doorkeeper. He's the most significant death of all. The one, the death that opens that door for us at all. Lie down in the grave with Jesus and God will take it from there, is what he's saying. The striving, the word strive can also be translated as struggle. So in this image, strive to enter the narrow door, struggle. Now, for myself, if I am really taking seriously the call to be last, least, lost, littlest, and dead, that is one hell of a struggle. It's not a struggle of achievement, it's a struggle of stripping off the layers of the stuff I coat myself in to be presentable into our culture. Our culture doesn't particularly have narrow doors, so the image is a bit lost. Except, oddly, at our house, where one door is quite below standard. It's the door to the toilet. We often say to people, up the passage and through the narrow door. You thought it'd get you somewhere more interesting. Our culture doesn't have a narrow door, but I think the equivalent for us is the back door. The interpretations about the piece in the wall are a defensive image, but the feast is a domestic image. In a domestic context, it's the back door and the front door. So then, if we read it that way, I'll reread the passage using that. Sir, will only a few be saved? Try your hardest to enter through the back door, because many will try to enter through the front door and not succeed. Once the master has got up and locked the front door, you'll knock and not be given entry. And there'll be weeping and grinding of teeth when you see everyone inside partying come from all corners of the world to feast with God. Surely the last will be first, and the first will be last. To me, this reading makes more sense of that conclusion. The back door is where friends and family come. The front door is where you present your resume. The back door is also an expression in our culture for getting places that maybe you weren't meant to get, but someone gave you a boost up. You know, how did you get your job? Oh, I got in through the back door. How did you get into heaven? Ah, got in through the back door. I think that's what this is about. Now, I have to be up front. Capone is the only person I read, and I read many, who go anywhere near this interpretation of the door as death. So if in your discerning, having many people having the opinion is important to you, then I wouldn't choose this one. In fact, I really wouldn't choose the next one because I didn't find anyone who said the next one. This is just me. At least Capon got himself published in a book. My reading, this is the fourth, what I think is a valid reading, is to read the verses before as the context. Immediately before this passage we have, Jesus went on to say, what is the kingdom of God like? What shall I compare it with? It's like a mustard seed, which a man took and threw into his garden. It grew and became a tree, and the birds of the air sheltered in the branches. And again he said, what shall I compare the kingdom of God with? It's like the yeast a woman took and mixed in 3 measures of flour till it was leavened all through. And then it says, he went through all the towns, teaching and preaching. And someone said to him, sir, how many will be saved? And he says, try to enter through the narrow door. All the Bibles, all the commentaries cut between those as separate things. But the Greek text doesn't have headings and markers. We are deciding where those headings are. Both the yeast and the mustard seed are tiny, hidden things which get completely lost in a bigger thing to bring transformation. The kingdom is so abundant that it's wasteful. Tossed into the garden, it creates a shelter for hundreds of birds. Kneaded into dough, it turns a two-dimensional thing into a three-dimensional thing. That's the yeast. To feed the hungry, shelter and food, these are not abstract things. And Jesus goes through all the towns and preaches this mysterious transformation from tiny things to marvellous, generous things. And some dimwit still asks, well, how many will be saved? And you can almost hear him say, you know, I mean, what the context is, how many will be saved? If I add the number of people baptised to the number of people who go to church and take away the number who read their Bible, divide by the square root of how many feed the poor, how many... This is the kind of question that's being asked. And I have found websites that have these as formulas, equation. People are doing this question. You can almost hear Jesus say, oh, come on, try your hardest. This is a new way of thinking. These big old questions of how many will be saved, they're a great wide door into nothing. And that door is closing. I'm here telling you how this tiny kernel of a kingdom, this narrow door, is the entry point into something enormous and marvellous. Bread for all, shelter for the whole world, a feast for everyone, from all over. Give up on the how many already. Jesus as the narrow door, Jesus as the yeast, Jesus as the mustard seed, is the least expected thing. A ragged Messiah from Galilee. Now, Galilee, most Jews didn't even consider really to be Israel. It's like a Messiah for Australia coming from Christmas Island and saying, I'm a real Aussie. That's Galilee. A Messiah from Galilee, hanging out with outcasts, preaching upheaval to the establishment, and eventually, shamefully, dead. This is the incarnation that we wait for through Advent and celebrate at Easter and wrestle with all our lives. God choosing a weak, fallible, limited human being, one person in one culture, in one time, to transform the whole world. That's a narrow door. We wait in the darkness for God to bring light, but it comes in ways we never expect. And the householder getting up to shut the door, I think we need to read it as Capon does, as two different doors. And the wide door of theoretical discussion and hypotheticals and navel-gazing, or just hero worship, is closing. The master of the feast had enough of that. And when you come beating on the door, on that door, with your sense of entitlement, he won't recognise you. He's not pretending, he really won't. You might have seen him talking, you might have had meals with him, but if you were there on your own agenda, how many will be saved? I've earned a place in the table of heaven, haven't I? Look how bright my little light is shining. While he was there trying to show you an upside-down, inside-out mystery, if you're caught up in these fantasies, then you weren't in the same place as Jesus, and he won't recognise you. And the door you're beating on doesn't lead where you want it to go. Go around the back to the narrow door. the one about the size of a mustard seed or a grain of yeast, where the mysterious transformation of God is happening. If you insist on keeping a score sheet of your achievements and bringing it to performance review meetings with God, you'll find the door to that meeting room locked and shut. And when you peer through the window and see a great party going on inside, you'll think, how did they all get there? Well, they dumped their scorecards in the bin and went round the back with nothing to commend them, as dirty and insignificant as buried mustard seeds or yeast mixed into flour, on God's terms, not on their terms, and grew into the celebration of life that is God's kingdom. And the last verse is a natural conclusion then. The teeny tiny mustard seed yeast narrow door, which is usually the last place people look when they want big results, is where it all starts. But note, the last doesn't mean not at all. Perhaps the people who are where they are now will stay at that front door until everyone else has gone round the back and they finally scratch their head and wonder where they are and go and investigate and stumble in. Bit like catching the last ferry. It doesn't mean you didn't cross over, it just meant everyone else got there first. I think this is a valid reading, and it's the one I mostly settle with. So what does it mean to struggle for the back door? I think it means let go of these questions like how many will be saved and get on with getting to know the one holding the feast. Not just in passing to claim his acquaintance, but really get to know him, listen to him, learn from him and love him. And know that you are loved and welcomed. Not on your performance, but on your God-created you-ness. And let your self-centered self shrink away to nothing. Let that less than a mustard seed, a shadow through a narrow door, and become subsumed and transformed by the presence of love. Is this all about heaven and tickets to eternity? Absolutely not. Because salvation is about making whole, about being transformed over and over and evermore into your true self, your God self, being kingdomed. I will use it as a verb. From that place, you cannot but respond to living out the things Jesus was on about: love, compassion, mercy, justice. But none of those responses is the reason God is kingdoming you. It's the outcome. As we enter Advent, the time of waiting for light in the darkness, lie yourself down in that grave of darkness. And don't give up struggling for transformation that comes from the most unexpected, tiny presence of God. Does anyone have a question or a comment? We've got about 5 minutes.
I just wanted to say amen and thank you for the patience.
Just an observation, really. In the first reading, it sounded an awful lot like our government's approach to asylum seekers and refugees, how they're allowed or not allowed into the country. Yeah. Struck me that way.
This could be interesting. When you were talking, this might be pointless. When you were talking, I was thinking about the discourse 2 weekends ago on the last weekend on the news about the rallies between the I Am Australia and the refugees welcome. And there was nothing, there was no violence in Perth, but Jared had his open house and screening of his Compass episode. But the news, the wide door, talked about the violence and the anger and the discord.
And it just, at the time, it really struck me, you know, we don't talk about the narrow door. We don't talk about the little things as a wide discourse. People can't hear it. They have to be in it. They have to be in the yeast or the flour.
No one else. I can't believe Man Hawthorne's got nothing to say. All right, I'll hand it back to Marita then. I think we're done.
Thanks, Claire. I think